Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
If you ask me about, the trust factor of it all, I mean, I've always, put my trust in the Seahawks. I think part of that is how we go about the protection part of it and figuring those little things out like that. Those are important things.
Fans are going to want to know, are you frustrated with the Seahawks?
I'm frustrated at getting hit too much. I'm frustrated with that part of it.
Russell Wilson is not happy. He's making it very clear that he is not happy, and there seems to be a bit of a public relations war brewing here, at least from his side of things. And The Athletic Seattle did a tremendous job reporting on this yesterday. Michael Sean Duggar and Mike Sando and Jason Jenks. Yep, I said Mike Sando because he's here with us. He's at Sando NFL on Twitter. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apford.com. Mike, how are you?
Good. Good morning.
Morning. That was that's a very complete story that you and your teammates did, and I come away from it thinking that it's kind of a garden variety sports power struggle in a lot of ways is what it sounds like. That we've got typical player ego and coach ego involved, and it also seems like the kind of thing that should be easily remedied by hug it out, bitches, get in a room and figure it out and make this all go away. Do you think that's possible?
First off, I love your analysis. Okay, I've probably done 12 radio shows since yesterday, and you being in Chicago are uniquely equipped to just describe it perfectly, because you've been there, done that. You're like, we've been through the Bulls stuff. We've been through Jordan and Phil Jackson and whatever. This is freaking nothing. We can solve this easily. So I appreciate that. I think you're right that there are those personalities involved in it. I mean, Russell Wilson has been paid $50 million in the last year. Pete Carroll and John Schneider, the front office, have just signed new long contracts, right? So everybody is fairly empowered here. And we're also at a time, I think, when players and quarterbacks are flexing more frequently, and they've always flexed. Quarterbacks have always been special and treated differently, but I think we've seen more of them kind of doing it now. And when Russell Wilson, after the Super Bowl, went public talking about his offensive line and a desire for more power and that stuff, it does raise an issue. I think your point is valid if we can take it face value. Russell Wilson's complaints are really all he cares about. Because if he wants out for whatever reason and just isn't saying it, then it's different.
The background that the story had was so extensive and important because it weighted it as well. The incidents that led to the point that he's at now with this Seattle team. And I think one of the biggest notes that I take away from it is the public nature with which he spoke. It was the understanding, according to what you guys said, that that wasn't going to be the case. It was going to be kept behind closed doors, and now it's out in the open, and here we are.
Yes, and so we're asking, okay, for what purposes, right? Usually when things have gotten out before, it was around a contract negotiation. There's a clear end to it, right? You want more money. You want a deal. You want to put pressure on the team in some way to get the best deal you can. Well, Russell Wilson has 3 years left on his contract, so there's not really a contract coming out. So you go, okay, does he want power over the scheme? Well, they just hired an offensive coordinator and let him sit in on that, and he publicly endorsed it. So I don't know if that's it. Is it Pete Carroll? Does he think that Pete needs to be out of there? Well, that's going to be harder to probably get, right? I mean, are they going to really get a different coach for him? You know, I think we're wondering what is the end? You know, what has to happen? Because I don't, if it was just as simple as say nice things, and then that would have already happened, I think.
So much is focused on that one bad game, that one 7-turnover game that seemed to be a shock to the system of Pete Carroll's football sensibilities. And ever since then, there has been some push and pull with the risk calculation in the offense. And I find it interesting that he's hanging his hat, Wilson is hanging his hat on this idea of, well, I'm getting hit back there, like he's David Carr. When in fact, there have also those have said, look, if you are smarter about your decision making, if the ball comes out when it's supposed to, if you're not running around when that's not the arrangement of the protection, that you can make it easier on yourself. That there has been some pushback there, and maybe some people a little insulted by him talking about how he's being hit. Who's at fault for that as this offense has moved recently in fits and starts?
I think that what happened to them in the second half of the season was that teams adjusted to playing them as a pass-first team. So they had always been a team that you had to stop the run if you played Seattle. I think people got wise and started defending the pass. Then they also played in the second half of the season a number of teams with really good defensive fronts, even though they weren't necessarily great teams. Teams like Philadelphia, the Giants, Washington, the Rams, they played them a bunch of times late in the year, and I think you are going to have harder games against those types of teams. Earlier in the year, they didn't have as many as those teams. They're playing Atlanta early in the year, Dallas in disarray, Minnesota early in the year when they were breaking in new players. You know, they got San Francisco at a bad time for the 49ers. They played Buffalo, even though that was a bad game for Seattle. They weren't a good defense. I think that changed a lot. And then the perception was that Pete Carroll really put the wraps on the offense, and I think that bothered Russell Wilson, even though, I mean, he did put the wraps on it, but it wasn't just, they didn't just stop trying to throw the ball. You know, I think it just wasn't as productive, and Russell Wilson went from being a betting favorite, prohibitive favorite for MVP, to being an also-ran. I think that was tough to take.
The difference between the first half of the season and his performance and how people are talking about him compared to the second half wasn't just notable. It was stark contrast, that drop off. What was the morale like? What did you pick up on in that second half of the season when we saw the points go down, the yards go down, the losses start to pile up?
Yeah, they went 6-2 in their final eight games, and so it wasn't like a complete disaster. You know, they won enough to sort of keep that at bay, but there was kind of a tension throughout the season in terms of, can they get it back for the playoffs? Because everybody knew, you know, once you got to playoffs, it wasn't going to be good enough to try to win 20-9, you know, or 20-15. Those were some of their scores late in the season. So there was a sort of wait to see how that would go. And then when they got in the playoffs, they didn't just lose. They were bad. You know, and the quarterback had two more turnovers. They couldn't do anything offensively. I think the Rams had their number. And so it ended on a really sour note that sort of brought together, almost harnessed all of those tensions that were there during the regular season. It sort of brought them all to bear all at once. And you could tell at the end of the year, something was going to happen. Like the way Pete Carroll was interviewed in his end of the final game press conference and the next day, like, I knew something was going to happen, and it was the firing of the offensive coordinator, because he was saying things that you say when you're mad, you know, you're mad or frustrated.
Why would any quarterback in his right mind put Chicago on a short list of preferred destinations?
I was thinking of that while I was waiting to come on here, because I knew you were going to ask me that. And when we looked at the other teams that were listed, right, the Saints, the Raiders, and the Cowboys, some of them, there would be more obvious reasons of an established offensive coach, you know, the scheme, whatever. As I look at it, I think I would see, you know, Russell Wilson might look at the sort of branding of those teams. If you were to look at the Cowboys, America's team, the Raiders are kind of an iconic team, you know, the same colors and logo forever. And you say the Raiders, and it doesn't even matter where you're from. Raiders fans are all over. They're a national team also. Are the Bears kind of an iconic team and franchise as well, where he could see sort of his destiny of going there and bringing a championship to a great city and a great sports city? That's kind of guessing, but I'm with you. I was looking at it too, going, you know, just based on how they've played recently or what they have or who their coach is, it didn't fit as well.
Maybe it's just kind of in-town stupid. Maybe it's because, and you know, it's funny, when Matt Nagy took the job, he talked about being awestruck walking into Halas Hall, the name George Halas still meaning something. I mean, we roll our eyes every national broadcast. It's like Sid Luckman and Dick Butkus, all this grainy black and white footage. And it's just like enough already. It's just living off this history. But maybe the perspective outside of here is different. And there is something sort of august about the brand.
Yeah, that really could be. I was struck the other day, one of our guys, Kevin Fishbane, wrote a piece about the backup quarterbacks, you know. And,
great piece.
Yeah, I was struck reading it from afar, right? I mean, I've been to Chicago many times. I've watched the Bears for years, but I'm not there. I don't have a sense of it like you guys do. But the way they talked about the organization and how the organization takes care of them, and was just like something that I wasn't that aware of, you know. And it just struck me a little bit about them, and not that would affect Russell Wilson, but the sort of perception you have of an organization can be different based on who you are and where you're at, right?
Sure. But when you talk about the priority that Wilson places on the Hall of Fame company he wants to keep, as you mentioned in that article, I don't know that you're going to add to a Hall of Fame resume with the Bears in their current state.
I mean, I'm with you. I think the list is puzzling. I was shocked, really, that the agent on the record, by the way, it wasn't like Adam Schefter wasn't like, hey, I'm hearing, you know, he's like the agent for the player, Mark Rogers, is saying that they're not demanding a trade. But if there was one, these would be the four teams. I thought, I'm not sure why you would do that if you want to keep alive some sort of a hope of a trade to limit it to four teams. And then, yeah, the reasoning of picking Chicago, I guess you'd have to ask Russell Wilson. It really could be as simple as I've always wanted to be a Bear. Who knows, right? It could be. I think we're overthinking it if we start looking at their roster or their cap situation or anything like that. It's probably not that well researched.
The most passive-aggressive trade demand in the history of trade demands, I think, is what that was. But and help me out here in larger picture. We were debating earlier in the show the role of Tom Brady and sort of setting the tone for quarterback self-empowerment. And I can understand if you're Russell Wilson, you see, okay, I've got this, you know, famous model wife, and I'm 10 years younger, and I'm in a position to do this. I can do this too. And we'll never know what that meant. But the reason why there's something that's similar with Brady and Wilson to me is I find both of them a little odd. And I don't ever quite know what's real when they talk or what's performance. And there's just something not quite right with it. I can't quite explain it other than it's an old reporter instinct. And it's just kind of it's a spider sense where I don't know where he's coming from sometimes. And I don't like to throw the term phony around because of those connotations, but there's something, there's a veneer, there's a layer in there where I don't know what's real or not. Is that fair? And do you understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah. You don't get to see the real them. And even when you think it is the real them, it might not be. You know, they have that about them for sure. You know, and I think in Seattle, it's been written about in the past about, you know, remember when they had that great defense and there were stories that would come out about, you know, how is he aloof from his teammates or is he one of the guys, all that type of stuff. And at the end of the day, probably didn't matter a whole lot because he's playing great football, right? And the same may be true in a different way for Brady. But yes, I think that's fair. And that exact sort of, you're not the first person I've heard say that, you know? And so I think there's something to that. And, you know, what does it mean in the end? I think it means we're guessing at what the real end game is, right? Isn't that what we're doing? We're like, okay, he doesn't want maybe to leave Seattle because they're one offensive lineman different from what they should be, right? That wouldn't be why you'd want to leave a team, right? There was absolutely nobody. I live in the Seattle area. There was absolutely nobody after the season who was saying, God, Russell Wilson's been sacked 394 times in his career. That's got to be fixed. No one was talking about that at all. It's not the number one issue for the team. And so when it gets to this with the agent putting up the teams, you're like, okay, is that really what it is? You know, I feel like we don't really know what it is, and we're not sure Russell Wilson would tell us what it is, just like Tom Brady, like you said.
When you talk about, in the article, it mentions him seeing ghosts. How much do you think that that stays with him no matter where he is under center next season?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the fear is that same coach I was talking to about that, you know, was like, hey, alarm bells went off in his head. When you have when a quarterback starts being worried about getting hit, then it affects how they play. So I think there's somewhat of a concern that I'll be watching next year because he's always been a fearless player, you know, taking hits, whatever. But if he's really thinking about his legacy in the way that he described, we're not making that up. He was talking about Tom and LeBron and legacy and all this stuff. Wants to play 10 more years. The line's not good enough. Excuse me. If that was why he was like that late in the season, then why is that going to change? And I think that's a concern that no one's talking about except for football people who worry about such things, but I think it's a great question.
This is really good stuff, Mike Sando. This, and the reporting job that you guys did was tremendous, and I expect there's going to be more in the coming days as we get this figured out. It just seeing the Bears on this list, it makes it, you know, all of a sudden we're pulled into this story in a way we certainly didn't expect, and appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
That is Mike Sando of The Athletic. When we come back, I guess we have to call it Score Tales now because we've had a copyright infringement lawsuit that's been slapped on us by the powerful legal team that represents the Parkinson Spiegel show. I think Shane Reardon.
I think it was Grody.
Well, no, Grody started it, but he was just the conduit. He was like the process server. He was like the one who actually came out and slapped us with the suit. So we'll figure out what it's called, and we're going to talk about it. If you haven't heard this story before, you know, the late author, essayist, David Foster Wallace, has had a long-standing connection and had to the Boers and Bernstein show and to the station. He was a Score P1 as well as being one of the most significant writers of his generation. He was also kind of just a fascinating person and shared a lot of himself in his writing. And I've got a letter here, one that he wrote to me. I'll tell you the story of how this happened. And I've never ever read any of this before on the air. This is a letter dated 4801.
Wow.
And it's a bunch of his thoughts about the score at the time and what it was. And these is David Foster Wallace's words that he sent to me personally that have never been heard before. So we'll do that next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
I am the new kid around here. I love hearing the references and just the backstories and even the impersonations you guys do. And people love it.
Guilty as charged with the story.
So I decided we need to do some classic Score audio and just like catch me up to speed.
Score Stories with Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi.
Do you guys know, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but you guys do that Score Story segment. The afternoon show has been sniping at you guys. They think that you stole that title from them.
Maybe we'll hear that on Score Stories on the midday show. Have they pirated that yet? Have they done anything else? Do they call their listeners a mob by any chance? Do they?
I'm sure it's coming. Well, they're our friends. They can steal anything they want.
They brought it up twice now.
Well, I don't have to say much because I'm not the one who came up with the segment. So if they're mad, I get it.
Score Tales! Woo-hoo. Score Stories was used already. Score Tales! Woo-hoo. Parkins and Spiegel told us not to use it. Score Tales! Woo-hoo. Score Tales with Bernstein and Rahimi on 670 The Score.
You happy now? Is that okay? That's awesome.
I don't know.
I don't know
is
that
Darkwing
music.
Duck next? I need to know these things.
I don't know that music. Is that from something?
DuckTales! Woo.
Got
oh
nothing.
My gosh.
I got nothing on DuckTales.
Okay.
Sorry.
DuckTales was a Disney cartoon that appeared in the afternoons. Which afternoon? I can't recall. Whatever afternoon you were feeling lucky. Maybe you had some fruit snacks, got yourself a little DuckTales watching. Scrooge McDuck. Was there a rich grandfather that they went to live
well,
with?
I know Scrooge McDuck. That's a famous Disney character going back to the 1940s.
Yes, but he was realized in DuckTales.
Okay, so that was Donald's
grandfather,
right?
That's the theme song.
Right? Okay,
so we kind of stole DuckTales and ScoreTales, and I don't care anymore. Whatever works. That's amazing.
So in 1997, I think I picked this up in an airport bookstore. Airport newsstand, and it's the book A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again by David Foster Wallace, a collection of his essays. And I read it, and I was so blown away by his prose, by his journalistic style, everything. I just said, it was as if a voice was speaking to me in this way that no one else had before. And it was literally like a life-changing book. And I dove in and I read about Infinite Jest and I studied about Infinite Jest and decided I would spend a summer reading Infinite Jest. And that's what it took. And it's thousands of pages and multiple bookmarks and a nonlinear narrative and one of the great American novels, as has been recognized. And he was one of the great American intellects who tragically had suffered severe depression and mental illness all his life and took his life at age 46 in 2008. But for a while, he was living in Bloomington, Illinois, when he was teaching at Illinois State University. That's where you can see from the Department of English, Illinois State University, from whence this was sent. And
so cool.
What happened was I was raving to my sister about this author that I discovered and how wonderful he was. And she's like, oh, I'm working with him on something here at Premier. She at the time was an editor at Premier Magazine, and he wrote freelance articles for them about movies. And she said, yeah, I was just on the phone with him. I'm like, oh my God, you're on the phone with you really talking to him? And she said, yeah, if you want, it's here, send him a note. I can make sure I get him this note. So I wrote just on Score Stationery, I wrote a cute little card, and I was finishing Infinite Jest at the time, and I made a clear sub reference to a character, and then I added an end note and made a little jokey end note at the end. And I sent it off. It was just a fan letter, and I had no idea. I didn't know where he lived. I didn't know any. I just said, oh, this is so cool that I have access to send this guy a note. And then out of nowhere, this letter appeared. And you can see there are, he's got the typical handwritten notes in the margins. Even at the end, in his sign-off, he signed it. It says, Ave Atque Vale, and he signs it David Wallace. And then he writes in Foster in pen, because he felt compelled to do that. But this is what I received, and I remember reading this in the hallway on Belmont. Dear Mr. Bernstein, your very kind card arrived and elicited from me a response kind of like a Bobby Soxer at a Sinatra concert. I do rather more than listen to your silly show. For embarrassing personal reasons, I had to get rid of my TV, and so have become a devotee of radio, especially the AM, and I sort of stumbled onto you and Mr. Boers' show several months ago during Bears season, and now have become a drooling, rabid Boers and Bernstein fan. Said, despite the fact that I don't know or care about major sports except for Illinois basketball and Bears football, I listen to you guys just about every morning while I'm jick-jacking around getting ready to do what passes in my life for work. I know the whole thing. Who you crappin', secondhand news. Some days I end up with that damn Fleetwood Mac song stuck in my head in the same chorus-only loop you guys put it on. I could go on, and I have nobody to go on about it to. Nobody else I know down here in Bloomington listens to AM radio. If I might ask, what are you guys doing on WSCR as opposed to like being in New York or on TV? Because quality-wise, there's nothing on Chicago radio remotely as smart and funny as your show. Maybe Ro Khan and Gary Meyer on LS come close sometimes, but they're a little too slick and they don't take the obvious pleasure in each other that you and Mr. Boers do, or at least appear to do. He says, no offense, here come the questions. No offense, but who or even what species is this Mr. North? Whose show seems to be sponsored entirely by casinos and strip clubs. And then there's a series of parentheticals here. Though at least the ubiquitous Greg Rosinski and his Vitalman ads have vanished, probably through FCC intervention. I was big time amused when Rosinski's early commercial about discovering Vitalman while going through a very stressful lawsuit was replaced with very stressful time in my life, as apparently it occurred to this mental titan that maybe alluding to his getting sued was not the greatest product confidence booster of all time. And who, back to Mr. North, makes poor old Gale Sayers broadcast from Hooters? And what particular blend of medications and noble gases is this Tommy Williams on, who seems more like an SNL parody than an actual person? And who in God's name is the 900 phone number-ish lady who simpers about loving it when you call him Big Partner? This is real. This is one of the great American authors here, listening to way too much score. And there's a couple other personal things. And then there's this paragraph. He says, listen, though, last item. Could you or a factotum there maybe refer me to any specific essays or articles in Chicago newspapers or magazines that have profiled WSCR, or specifically you and Mr. Boers, or given some of the history of this weird station that runs something as fine as your show and also runs stuff like WrestleManiacs or North and Fritzy smoothing their comb-overs and high-fiving about how plowed they got the night before? Can you direct me to anything in radio industry publications about WSCR's ad demographic? The ads for places like Skybox, Dr. Chep Chen's male liposuction, and herbal tumescence are almost a gender sociology seminar in themselves. I'd reimburse for copying postage if you had an intern who could, like, make off-prints, or I can easily get the articles themselves if I have a specific enough date or title citation. Sorry to take up your time. I have literally no one else to talk to about this stuff. Thanks very, very much for taking the trouble to send the card. Isn't that lovely?
Where do we begin? That's the most well-written, but yet normal listener question letter there possibly could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a straightforward, hardcore listener asking questions about what this stuff all is. And that's kind of that's been the magic of the score, that there's no good answers to any of this stuff, right? There's no real way to give concrete answers to some of these questions.
David Foster Wallace, one of the greatest modern American authors.
Yes.
Reached out to you because he had nobody else to talk to about this.
Yeah, and and later on, you know, I replied with a long letter of my own. He sent back a nice postcard. He sent me a book by Don DeLillo he thought I'd like, and that was as he was leaving ISU and going to teach at Pomona, and just a brilliant guy. And somebody came up to me recently at a charity event that I did, not recently, it was the last time we were doing charity events, and she was a high school tennis teammate of Wallace, because he was a regionally ranked tennis player and competed at a pretty high level. And she had these long van rides and bus rides with him throughout high school and just described their conversations. And even though he was an intellect processing things at a completely different rate of speed and depth, she said he was really fun and normal and a very good dude. And she liked when we mentioned his name on the station. Also, if you read his essay in the book, Consider the Lobster, his essay about 9/11, he says that he learned of the plane hitting the tower because he was listening to us on the score, and he was listening to a Bears post game because he was big Bears fan and always tuned in for Bears Mondays. So the connection between him and Bears Mondays is something that he has put into his own writing.
So you've never read this on the air?
Nope. No, that's the first time since in 20 years.
What did you think when you read it? And what made you keep it to yourself?
I don't know. It was good. It was just kind of a personal thing, and I think it needed a little bit of the distance from some of it. And I don't know. I didn't think there'd be a whole ton of interest, and I think after his death, it sparked a lot more interest in his work. In fact, you know, the movie came out with Jason Segel portraying him about the media tour for Infinite Jest. And for people who are asking about Infinite Jest, it's not for everybody. It also, I will tell you, you will understand Jason Benetti's Twitter bio page. There's nobody who loves that book more than Jason Benetti and has thought about it and probably written about it, but has, and I think he even has like an Enfield tennis shirt that he found somewhere. But he and I have shared a lot of time talking about that. But it's not for everyone. It's a very difficult read. It's entertaining as hell. It is time consuming. It rewires your brain for a while. Going through that experience, and part of it is the experience of reading that book, but going through it is it changes the way your brain works, and it's worth it. It's worth doing, but it's a great full summer read. And if you do plan on doing it, I have some advice for how to do it, so feel free to reach out to me.
I'm here for this advice, but why are you telling this now? We should have done this during quarantine.
I don't know. I guess I hadn't really thought about it.
Oh, I'm being sarcastic. Yeah. There's whatever time it is always the right time.
Yeah. It also, it just, I don't know. I get melancholy about it because it's a world without him. And I don't know how he would have been or done in an era of Twitter and Twitch and everything else. And because so much of it, linguists have written about his effect on the way that we speak on some of those platforms and how he saw a lot of this coming and not necessarily for the better. And there are a lot of great writers and brilliant people out there. I've told him this directly. David Roth, who writes for The Defector, former Deadspin, he's been a guest on the show before. I think he's the closest that we have as an heir to sort of the cultural criticism and a different way of looking at the world, a kind of a special intellect. The closest that at least resonates with me right now is David Roth. So as long as he's around, we're in some good hands on a lot of levels. But I guess part of me just gets sad that we don't get to hear from him anymore. But that was new. That was different. And that was what Score Tales, Score Lore, Score Stories, whatever you want to call it. That's what it was. We heard some interesting things from Patrick Kane last night, I thought, and I think you will find them interesting because maybe it's a very good sign for the evolution of the Blackhawks coming off that 2-0 win last night. Next on The Score.
Score Tales! Woo-hoo. Score Stories was used already. Score Tales! Woo-hoo. Perkins and Spiegel told us not to use it. Score Tales! Woo-hoo. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
Carried on by Kane. He cuts in with a stop time. He scores! Patrick Kane, career goal 399, and a big one there. Puts his team in front.
Big milestone goal to come very, very soon for Patrick Kane. Nice win for the Blackhawks last night. They're able to get by Patrick Laine and the Jackets. Malcolm Subban gets his first shutout as a Blackhawks goaltender. Made a couple of highlight saves, one post-to-poster early on that was pretty cool. Although he does seem to have to recover from his big saves, doesn't he? It's like Lankin just sort of like flick, 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 and Subban's like, blah! He just has to take him a while to get up.
Performance art. It's performance art.
Just don't lose your net, young man. You know, make that save, pad up, and make the next one. After the game, Patrick Kane had a Zoom press conference with reporters, and I just want to play 30 seconds or so of what he had to say. Mark his words carefully here.
You know, it's just kind of believing in our game plan and the way we play, and I think when you get that confidence, in the team game. It just kind of takes over no matter what's going on. Maybe the last couple of years we wouldn't come up with points, or we'd, you know, struggle to find a way to win those. And, you know, this year I think we're just kind of sticking to the structure, sticking to the way we need to play, and we know that works for us. So I think when you have that confidence in the game plan and in the structure, then you can just play that way till the end and hopefully get a break. And that's obviously what happened tonight.
Do you hear what I hear?
What's that?
Full-throated endorsement of Jeremy Colleton and a system against which many of the Quenneville veterans pushed back and muttered about and refused to accept. And maybe it started with Duncan Keith in the preseason talking about having done some coaching, and maybe, you know, not having Brent Seabrook around the team. I thought that mattered. I thought that is as much for the young players to hear as it is for the media to hear.
I agree with you, and I'm not a huge proponent in general, having reported sports for a long time, on the team's all in, because I think usually that doesn't matter a whole lot. But when you consider how they came to absorb Jeremy Colleton's teachings and his leadership, I think that this does absolutely matter. And the difference, too, is that Kane is, yet again, putting the goals where his mouth is, right? Mm-hmm. He's on pace statistically for one of his best seasons ever. In fact, the stat that I saw said, if you project it across 82 right now, the clip he's on, 37 goals, 86 assists, that'd be 123 points. That passes his career high in points, by the way, if that holds. He is on a tear. And for him to say, not just what he's doing on the ice, but the fact that the coach is the one helping make that happen matters. I think that that's a big deal.
Especially with Jonathan Toews not around, especially with the leadership vacuum that's here and the number of rookies and young players that they have, Kane's never been a vocal leader. And maybe in his old age, he's feeling a little bit more comfortable doing that, because usually that's been the captain's job. Captain's not here. We certainly hope he's okay, and we don't have any more information as to what's going on there. A lot of people are asking, but I thought that was substantial. And Jeremy Colleton's been pretty open about how his personality doesn't lend itself to being, you know, this hard ass, you know, rock chewing alpha kind of coach, that it may take him some time to ingratiate himself. And it may be something as much as the team having to feel it happen. Having to say, okay, I now we're going to give it a shot, and the system is starting to work. But with all these rookies and all these people around, maybe that's one of the cooler things that maybe we're learning why they're way more successful than we thought, because the system does work. It's the man-to-man defense, the pressuring on offense, where they have guys in their breakouts. The power play has been better, finally. Even when they've been good, we said, what's wrong with the power play? So I guess I'm more than guardedly optimistic.
Right. When an athlete buys in and you see the production show for it, that's what makes a difference. It's like you talking to Russ Dorsey earlier in the show. When you have proof that your methods work,
yes,
then that's what matters. And in this case, that's what we're seeing. But Jeremy Colleton has also been pretty pointed in his comments during the season this year. And I know he was trying to get somebody to listen, because I was like, oh, wait, who's he talking about there? Oh,
yeah,
that was,
when he was talking about some of the turnovers. Strong. Yeah, when they were
naive
losing games.
With the puck.
Yeah. You're right. And maybe he just feels like he knows he's in a better position. He can tell. A coach knows if they're listening to him or not. He knows how crisp his practices are. He knows. And maybe he feels that he's now in a place where some of that stuff's going to resonate differently or better.
But for Patrick Kane, how do you describe his talent? You don't. You just let it speak for itself. His resume speaks for itself. To be saying that, you're right. That has a lot of indication that it's a same page production right now.
I heard it. And I think that's going to inform, going forward, perhaps some of the decisions they make on some of these other players that are really outperforming what we thought they would be. Coach has to get credit for that without question. I also want to double back to, it's really important that when we were talking about DFW, that you mentioned his graduation address, his commencement address at Kenyon,
which has now been republished into something called This Is Water. It's wonderful. I've mentioned it before. I try to read it in full once a year just to sort of recenter myself. And it, in large part, is the greatest description and definition of what it takes to be an empathetic human being. It is just a perfect way to encapsulate the true meaning of empathy. There's a video that you can watch. You can read it in its text. There have been different versions of it, but This Is Water, the Wallace address to Kenyon, is something that is absolutely worth seeking out.
It's been discussed a lot. Empathy sometimes can be confused with sensitivity. I found it interesting that it was Kenyon, and it's out there for people to consume for free, and I found it to be pretty awesome.
It is awesome. It really is. It's something that it's good to read every once in a while. I find that I have to remind myself to do so. We're going to talk with Mark Grody. We call that transition. It's next on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.